off a little bit. I was joking with somebody before services that this is kind of the downside to preaching two-part sermons. You preach the first half of it and people don't like it. Well, they don't come back for the second half. I trust that's out. I know we had a lot of visitors this morning who we did not necessarily expect to come back. And I know we have a lot of members out. But we are privileged to have you here. I'm glad that you are. Appreciate it very much. I appreciate the song that we just sang, "Great is Thy Faithfulness." You know, and singing that in connection with the text in Isaiah 41, and in the context of the discussion that we're having today about trusting in God, especially in moments when we have found that we're not really in position to trust our government as much as perhaps we have in the past. "Great is Thy Faithfulness." And we look at what God has done for us in the United States. And we give Him the glory for that, and we should. And we thank Him for this marvelous opportunity that we've had to live in this country and live under the blessings and the services and the oversight that our country has provided for us. And we look at this marvelous picture that Isaiah gives us with regard to the people of Israel and their conflict over the enemy, and how he's going to make them, I love the language there about making them like threshing sledges. A new sharp threshing sledge with double edges. Verse 15, you'll thresh the mountains and pulverize them and make the hills like chaff. You know, Jesus talks about prayer that moves mountains. And God says here, I'm going to equip you so where there's this mountain in front of you that seems impassable, that it's absolutely permanent, absolutely stable, and I'm going to equip you to render it to dust. And we think, man, that sounds really great. I would love that to be the case. And I'm sure poetic language is being used here, but the poetic language means something. It's got to mean some kind of success, tremendous, remarkable success. And when we start thinking about our nation in terms of being protected by our government, and our mind goes back to the days of the pilgrims back 400 years ago, where they came to these shores literally to establish a new Jerusalem, literally to found a nation in which God's rules would always apply, and that God would literally take care of them, and that would literally lead them to victory. And the curses that came upon the nation when they disobeyed would literally be their curses. And they believed that God was with them every single step of the way, giving them success. And when they deserved it, giving them punishment. And founding a nation on principles like that, it's very easy for us to assume that we're the good guys. And that our government is the good guys. And I think in our saner moments, we realize that's not the case. Not necessarily the case, at least. But it's a hard transition for us to make when we start thinking about the ones who are supposed to be our caretakers, the ones who are supposed to be those who are securing our rights and securing our freedoms, that they themselves have become our enemies. That is a hard pill for us to swallow. And I fear that is going to be more and more the case rather than less and less the case in coming years. Again, I'm prepared to be proved wrong on that, but we shall see. We started a consideration of this here this morning, and I'd like to continue with what we were talking about. If you had your outline, and you'll pick up where we left off. Protection. Government does not protect the church. God protects the church. This is where we receive our protection. I'm going to get around to some practical applications and some takeaways here at the end, but allow me to give you one for free here before we get into that. Can we have a moratorium, it doesn't have to be a long one, a moratorium, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, something like that, on the use of the term tax-exempt status? Because I have heard this so much, really not just in recent days, but over the last 10, 15 years or so, that this is going to be a club that the government has to hold over our heads. And if, you know, one of these days, you know, it might be that the government asks something of us And if we're not willing to apply that, they might revoke our tax-exempt status. Like that's the same thing as putting us all in prison or chopping our heads off or something like that. And don't get me wrong, I'm pleased to live in a country where churches are tax-exempt. I think there's a lot of advantages to that. Clearly, it's tough to think of a worse use, frankly, for money than giving it to the government. I mean, I'm sure we could figure out something else to do with our money rather than give it to the government. But that being said, I think that we have convinced ourselves that somehow or another, if we lose tax-exempt status, then all is lost. Well, we may not be able to afford to pay preachers. Well, you know, I certainly hope that's not the case, but maybe. We may not be able to afford church buildings. Well, you know, maybe not. That would not necessarily, though, be the end of Christian civilization on these shores. 10 years ago, when we had this discussion about tax exempt status, it was like, well, you're going to have to one of these days we're going to have to back off of homosexual marriage or homosexuality, or back off of female leadership or whatever. And if we don't, then we're going to be threatened. As it turns out, our opponents have skipped a step. They've skipped right to the point where they're going to revoke our tax exempt status regardless of what we did. It doesn't matter what. Apparently, that's the new page in the playbook. They want to just cut it out entirely. Well, I hope that's not the case. I hope they don't do that necessarily. But have we bought into this idea that if the government does not offer us the protection that we have come to expect in our lifetime, that somehow some serious and permanent irreparable damage is done to the cause of Christ? I suggest to you, government does not have that power, and we cannot afford to act like it does have that power. The protection that we want from the government ultimately is... that could be taken a couple of different ways, I guess. The protection that we are seeking to receive from the government. Being protected from the government, that could be taken another way. Anyway, but the things that we want government to protect us from typically are visible things. And this goes back to this basic premise that we were talking about. The difference between the visible protection, the visible benefits that we receive from government versus the invisible things that we get from God. And if we're not careful, we can learn to value the visible things more than the invisible things. We want government to protect us from persecution. And again, we talked about that a little bit this morning. Government has told us that we are free to worship as we choose. And we've come to expect that. Free from discrimination. I realize these days Christians are the ones who are being accused of discrimination, but we would like to make those arguments too. We like to say that it's not fair for somebody to treat us unfavorably, to refuse some kind of credit or to impose some kind of fine or something like that simply because of our religious views. That's not appropriate. Government's supposed to be protecting us from that kind of thing. Slander, of course. Another classic example there. Lying is a bad thing. Lying's not generally a criminal thing, but it can be. There can be deceit sown in such a way as to cause serious damage. And there's a long history, legal history, of protecting people, and protecting organizations, from slander and libel. And we expect those laws to be upheld. We don't appreciate being lied about. It can do serious damage to the cause of Christ, to our own personal reputations. And we have reason to expect that government's not going to allow that kind of thing to happen. We have grown so accustomed, I fear, though, to these rights that we talked about last hour. These honors and privileges that government has freely given to us for almost a quarter of a millennium now. Written them into our founding documents. We have become so used to this, so accustomed to this, that we fear that we cannot serve Jesus Christ in the United States without Him. Which is, and I hope that we're at least at a surface level not willing to accept that, because we know perfectly well there are many, many untold numbers of people out there in the world today who are serving Jesus Christ just fine, and they do not have these protections. And beyond that, of course, going back to previous generations, going all the way back to the first century, There were people who were serving in very different governmental systems, oftentimes where the opposition to the church was overt rather than covert. And they served Jesus Christ just fine. We read about them in the Bible. And so we know, at least intellectually, that we don't absolutely have to have these things. But if the slightest danger rears its head that we might lose these things, again, it's like, how can we possibly go on? Well, I'll tell you how you go on. You go on by trusting in God. You go on by relying on Him, having your faith in Him, and the invisible protection that we would like to be visible, and sometimes it is, but ultimately the invisible protection that God offers us, that He talked about here in the text in Isaiah 41 that we're reading here. When we read this text about how God has chosen us, do not fear, He says in verse number 10 in Isaiah 41. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Similar images are seen throughout the text, especially in the Psalms. We sing a song, I believe Brother Bill led it for us during the gospel meeting. Unto the hills do I lift up my longing eyes. From whence shall my help come? My help comes from the Lord. And it's battle imagery, essentially, from Psalm 121, I believe it is. Maybe it's 122. 121, I believe. We're in the valley of battle, and we're looking around. Surely there's some reinforcements coming here. Where are they going to come from? Are they going to come from the north? Are they going to come from the south? What are we going to do? And, of course, we realize that we're looking to the north or looking to the south is not what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to look up. We look to God. God is the one who is going to support us. God is going to be the one who gives us the victory. But we realize that this poetic language that Isaiah gives here, that has application, I'm sure, to the literal people of Israel, and may have application to some literal battle that you're dealing with in your life. We realize that the greater truth is invisible. That the conflict that we are going through in this life is not going to always or even usually be resolved in some kind of physical conflict that goes our way, or intellectual conflict, or debate of some fashion. At the end of it, somebody's not going to come over here and raise our hand and say, yes, Christians are the winners, yay! That's not usually the way that it works. God's protection is going to be invisible. And so when we deal with these difficulties, like persecution, for instance, we want God to come running to our rescue and pull us out of this mess. And oftentimes He doesn't do that. And we are going to suffer persecution then. Instead of being delivered from persecution, instead God allows us to go through it. In fact, He promises it. All those who live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12. I'd like to read from 1 Peter chapter 2. In fact, you have your marker. You might put it in 1 Peter. We're going to be coming back to this text from time to time. In 1 Peter chapter 2, look at verse number 18. And this is in the context, of course, of slaves. And there's a big old discussion, of course, with regard to slavery in the Bible and why the Bible doesn't take a stronger stand against the evils of the day. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I will say this at least. In the context of our lesson here today, sometimes God lets bad things happen for His own reasons. And instead of removing the problem from our life, He chooses to equip us to deal with the problem. Now, you may not think that's fair. You may not feel that's appropriate or whatever. We'll take it up with the Lord in due course of time. But He says here in verse number 18, servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. For this finds favor if, for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is it there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it. This finds favor with God. Basically, what he's saying is you don't get any credit for suffering or doing stuff that you did wrong. We show ourselves to be the people of God when we suffer for things that were right. When we are persecuted for our cause and yet find a way to bear up under it. And if slaves were expected to bear up under rather extremely adverse circumstances, including when their masters were unreasonable, the text says, if that is an expectation God places upon Christians in that kind of situation, do we really think that we are exempt when our government doesn't pat us on the head like we feel like we deserve to be patted on the head? Protecting from persecution is not ultimately the government's job. It's God's job. Likewise, in chapter 4, discrimination, unfair treatment. Verse number 12, pardon me, of 1 Peter chapter 4. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the suffering of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory in God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or thief or evildoer or troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed, but he's to glorify God in this name. For it is time for judgment to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if it is with difficulty that the righteous is saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful God in doing what is right. He says here, we trust ourselves to God. We do what is right. And when people despise us for that, when they discriminate against us for that, God expects us to bear up under that. He expects us to take it with a smile, or to use the words of the Lord himself, to turn the other cheek. Why do we do that? Because judgment is coming. And if you think that your enemies are going to get off, you're kidding yourself. They are not going to get off. But you're being judged too. And part of this judgment process is seeing what kind of person you are, what kind of faith you have in these adverse circumstances. Are you able to bear up? And if you're not tested in this kind of situation, you'll be tested in some other kind of situation. Ultimately, we have to find a way to lean on God. It's God's job to protect us in these situations. Slander works the same way. Jesus says in the Beatitudes that we are blessed. This is the approved lifestyle, he says, when we trust ourselves to him and wind up suffering as a result of it. Now, that language is kind of confusing to people who don't know God and don't know Jesus. We read here in verse number 11, blessed are you when men shall insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice, he says, and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. How are we supposed to rejoice in this? How are we considering ourselves blessed when people lie about us? I hate being lied about. Anybody ever lie about you, tell a story about you, just to get under your skin, maybe to cause you some kind of harm, hurt a relationship that you're in, something like that? And what do? Well, you defend yourself, you tell the truth, and that is also couched as a lie by your enemies, and maybe the people will believe it. And we're just trying to do what's right. We're just trying to serve God. It's not reasonable, it's not fair that these kind of things happen to us. And yet they do. Surely God could set it up where we didn't have to put up with this kind of thing, couldn't he? Well, I trust that he could have, and he didn't. That ought to tell us something. God expects us to find a way to trust in him in these difficult times. It would be nice if in these moments, my malefactor is standing there with me, and he's got his hammer in his hand, and he's rearing back to lay another one across my jaw, and God stands up and says, no, this is my child. I'm going to take care of him. You have to go away. Go bother somebody else now. That would be a great form of protection, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be great if God would protect us like that? Why doesn't he protect us like that? I think it's because he wants us to build up our faith. Because he wants us to trust in him when we cannot see him, when he is invisible. That's where faith really comes in. After all, we walk by faith and not by sight. If we were to see God coming to our rescue, then that wouldn't be faith, would it? the faith comes in when we don't see God. Chapter 2 of 2 Peter and verse number 8, the text says, then that the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. Going through the first part of verse 10 there, and especially those who indulge the flesh and its corrupt desires and despise authority. God knows how to deliver his people. Do you believe that? Do you think that God is capable of delivering your soul when you trust it to him? If the answer is yes, then we can find a way to not get distracted when the physical things don't go our way. When our day-to-day activities seem to be lined up against us. Well, guess what? They are lined up against us. And they always have been. Maybe you didn't notice for a while. Maybe favorable circumstances blinded us to the reality of Satan's world. But here we are, with our eyes open, and we have the information at hand where we can decide whether we're going to believe in God or not believe in God. The question is a matter of faith. Are we willing to, as we talked about this morning, trust in the Lord? Wait on the Lord. Be strong. Let your heart take courage. Yes, wait on the Lord. That same kind of sentiment is given to us over and over and over again in the Psalms and elsewhere as well. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Trust in him. Believe that he is watching over you, that he will give us the protection that we need. We've got one other point. Government doesn't grant success. God does. We all love the American dream, right? I don't know that we have any first-generation immigrants in the house. We might have some second-generation. Probably do have some third-generation. And why do people come to these shores? Why do they continue to come? They come because in America, anything is possible. And because historically, this nation has provided a venue for people who didn't really have very much other than a dream and maybe a little bit of talent and a lot of work, that they could come here and make something for themselves. The government, by and large, had been instrumental in allowing that to be the case. And so we see one generation after another of immigrants, second-generation immigrants, native-born citizens, whatever, who have come to believe that because America is what it is, I can get what I want. I can get what I need here in this life. Well, what is it that we want? Well, usually it starts with money, right? When we talk about the American dream, aren't we usually talking about money? We don't usually use the word money, but that's what it is, right? We don't make a lot of money. We want to be able to provide for our family. We want to be able to have the nice house in the hills, or we want to have the 40 acres, or whatever it happens to be. We want to be able to provide financially for ourselves and for somebody else. Health. This is another bequest that government has given to us, especially in the modern day. It's become the government's responsibility, self-appointed responsibility, to make sure everybody's healthy. And they've pursued that in a variety of ways. And that may be a good thing, that may be a bad thing. But at any rate, the point is that government can give you what you need. Government can give you what you are most desirous of. Education works the same way for the last 150 years or so. Government has been instrumental in making sure that our young people get educated, that they get the learning that they need, they maybe even go on to college or beyond that, so that they can have the wherewithal to make something of themselves in this life. And this has all been secured by the government. Justice, of course, more than anything else. If something goes wrong, we can go to court. We can find a judge. We can find a lawyer. We can make this right. We can sue somebody. We can press charges, tell the police about some kind of crime or alleged crime that has taken place. And if things go according to the way they're supposed to go, at least, and I suggest even today go the way they usually go, you can get justice. And because we have a good form of government, because we have a favorable form of government, far better than the dictatorships that you see over in third world countries and various places, better than totalitarian regimes and oligarchies and on we could go. Because of this wonderful country that we have to live in, we can have some reason to expect that we can get the things out that we want, that we can become successful. Now, you'll notice, though, that all of these things, although they're fine and good as far as it goes, I don't have any issues with money or health or education or justice or maybe some other things we could put up here. These are fine things as far as that goes. But they're physical, aren't they? They're something that show up. They're tangible. If they're not literally physical, at least something that you can see, that you can prove it exists or it doesn't exist. And the second thing, of course, that they have in common is that we as Christians say, in times like this, when we're gathered together, that these are the things that don't really matter. Not ultimately. We like them all, and we spend a lot of time thinking about them, but what do we really value in this life? What we really value is our relationship with God, right? What we really value is heaven. That's what really matters, right? Well, in the modern day, in the history of the United States of America, since it was officially founded at least, government has never even claimed to be able to touch those things. And we certainly don't attribute those things to God. And so if these things are ultimately secondary in our life, are we really spending proper time and energy and emotion over the potential loss of these things? Are we allowing government to tell us what a successful life actually is? Let me suggest to you what I've suggested any number of times, and I'm sure other preachers have as well. God defines success for the Christian, and He blesses us in the way that He sees fit for His purposes, which may or may not put more money in your bank, which may or may not put another car in your driveway, which may or may not get you the extra bedroom, extra bathroom we wanted added on to the house. May or may not cure your disease or get your kid through dental school. But what it will do is secure your future in heaven. Since His purposes ultimately are spiritual purposes, we should not be overly concerned about the quantity or the quality of these physical things that we do ask God for and that we receive from God. But ultimately, if it's not about piling up a bunch of stuff, is it really significant when we don't get a big pile of stuff? Is that really the issue here? I fear that we want to have our cake and eat it too. You know, that's the way marriage works sometimes. We promise, you know, yes, I'm going to love her for better or for worse, as long as it's better. Yeah. In sickness and in health, as long as she's healthy. You know, but when the bad things come, that's a different kind of thing. Well, we want to be able to serve God first and foremost as long as we get this other stuff. And if we don't get this other stuff, then all of a sudden, hey, what's going on here? Where did the system fail us? Where's my house in the Hamptons? Where's my 2 weeks in Paris? Well, God didn't promise you those things, and you said you didn't value those things. So why is it that we're getting that worked up about it? However much you have is not really the issue. The issue is, what are you doing with what you do have? James says in his epistle, James chapter 4, starting verse 3, he says, "You ask from God," that is, "and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives so that you may spend it on your pleasures." That's what you're praying for. You're praying for stuff. "You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship of the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the Scripture speaks to no purpose? He jealously desires the Spirit which He has made to dwell in us. But He gives us a greater grace. Therefore, it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourself, therefore, to God." Going through the first part there of verse number 7. We have to find a way to submit ourselves to God. And when we think that our service to God consists largely, let alone entirely, of the kind of stuff that God gives us in this life, what we have essentially done is we have turned God into an ATM. We turn him into Santa Claus. His job is to give us things so that we'll have more things. And he calls that kind of person an adulteress. You're married to God. You're married to Jesus Christ. That was the agreement. He was going to be your Lord. He was going to be the one who rules your life. And this is the way that he's chosen to live, to rule your life. And it didn't wind up the way that you would have chosen. Well, here we are. Now you get to decide whether you really love the Lord or not. Are you really committed to the Lord or not? I'm not suggesting God isn't going to give you physical things. He has blessed us, tremendously blessed us in this life, far more than pretty much any other nation you can point to. But if that were suddenly not the case, if we were not successful by the world's standards, as successful as we have been, as we hope to be in the future, does that mean suddenly that faith is of no consequence? I suggest to you that's when faith is of its most consequence. Because in that hour we find out, are we really going to serve God? Are we really going to put him first in everything? Our job here on earth is not to become successful, however you may define successful in terms of the world. Our job is to use whatever level of success we have, however little or however much of it there is, to glorify God. Job gives us the blueprint for that. In Job chapter 1, verse 20 and 21, he talks about how he came into this world naked, going to go out naked. He says, "The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And we hold Job up as this tremendous model of character, this tremendous example of patience and fortitude and character. And then God asks us to give up something. And then suddenly we become less successful. Not because of a mistake we made, but because of what other people are doing. We're robbed, either at gunpoint or at the point of a pen, whatever it happens to be. Suddenly we do not have what we feel like we're entitled to, and now the system is broken. Because we have to go through a small fraction of what other faithful people have had to go through regularly in times past and even today. That's not why we're serving God. That's not our idea of success. Our idea of success is being what God wants us to be. Now, having said all that, that's basically the lesson. But I didn't want to leave without putting a handle of sorts on these lessons. So I'm giving you some points to take away here. And I'm going to start with this one. Quit obsessing over current events. Please, I'm begging you, and I'll be honest with you, especially with this point. Partly, I'm trying to save you from yourselves. Partly, I'm trying to help you sleep better at night and be more at peace and all that kind of thing. But part of it's because I'm sick and tired of reading about this stuff on Facebook. I really am. All my friends on Facebook are posting about these. The horrible thing that the Supreme Court did, or the horrible thing that some police department did, or this horrible thing that some group or individual did, or whatever, and doom and gloom and despair, and it's just depressing. I can't take it anymore. Let me give you another, tip here. If you ever find yourself going down a rabbit hole that you feel like you may never come out of, or whatever, go on a cleanse. Okay, go. 2 weeks without news. Go 2 weeks without social media. Whatever. Get it out of your system. Find out what your life really is all about. Obsessing like we are capable of doing in the modern day over all this horrible, horrible news. And I'm not denying this horrible news. And I'm not saying this is necessarily a long-term solution. But let's not live in the middle of all of this. And refuse to accept what Solomon said from the very early days. Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse number 8 and 9, "All things are wearisome, man is not able to tell it, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear with hearing. That which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done, so there is nothing new under the sun." And he goes on to say in verse 10 there, if there's anything of which one might say, "See, this it is new already has existed for ages, which were before us. The word news, you know, you would think that it means that it involves something that's new, right? That would seem to be part of the definition of news. In fact, it doesn't. It has nothing to do with news. But you would like to think that if we're reading something that is something changing, you know, something different or whatever. You know, this just in. World's a bad place. World's full of a bunch of bad people. Lots of bad stuff is happening. And because of Twitter, because of CNN, because of all of the things that we have in the modern day where we have instant access to pretty much anything that happens anywhere on the planet, we think the world's a lot worse place than it actually is. There's actually a lot of very, very good things out there. And I read a lot about, you know, read a lot about that too. That's good. But you're not likely to read a news article about 10,000 planes landed safely today. The bad news is more interesting. And if we're not careful, we can obsess on it too much. Read more history than you're reading the news. Read more Bible than you're reading history. Realize that the things that we're going through in this life are not especially unique. They may have a different color on them. They may be in a different shaped box. But this has always happened to human beings. And it certainly always happened to Christians. Gain a little bit of perspective in the big picture. Quit acting surprised when sinners don't act like Christians. Again, I'm begging you. Bad people are going to do bad stuff. Now, I don't know how you're defining Christian today or what flavor of Christian somebody might be in some a position of prominence or government or whatever. But the bottom line is, we're told from the very beginning of our service here to Christ that the narrow way is the one that leads to glory. The narrow way is the one that leads to eternal life. There are not going to be many people who find that. The broad way is the way that leads to destruction. We're living in Satan's world. We sing sometimes, "This is my Father's world." And it is, in the sense that God made it. But in a practical, day-to-day, moment-by-moment, hour-by-hour existence, this is the devil's world that we're living in. And most of the people who are running stuff are the devil's people. And we find out that one of the devil's people did something mean to somebody, and we act like something's gone wrong. How could they possibly... They're in defiance of common sense. They're in defiance of basic decent wisdom or basic decent morality. Or, you know, how could somebody be so awful? Because that's the way the world is. And maybe things were better in prominent places in our country 100 years ago. I don't know. I'm not old enough to tell one way or the other. But I'll tell you this, that if you have a country that is abandoning God as fast as it possibly can, running lickety-split away from God, you should not be surprised when bad things happen. And we're not going to take a time to read the text in Romans chapter 1. You know the story about this world that was given over to depravity, and the depravity started when they chose not to have God in their heart. When they decided they were not going to be God-oriented people, their world fell apart from a moral standpoint. And it got worse and worse and worse the further and further they departed from God. And we talk all the time about that happening in the United States. Am I the first person to mention this? Have you ever heard anybody bring this kind of thing up? You know what? People aren't talking about God anymore. People in government aren't concerned about God anymore. Our institutions aren't interested in God anymore. And because of that, all this horrible stuff is happening. Yes, that's right. And it started long before we noticed. And it's going to perpetuate itself, unfortunately. And maybe we can have a little bit of impact where we are. But if you think for one moment that the key to prosperity and success and a happy, peaceful existence in this life is for bad people to suddenly start doing good things, you are deluded. That is a waste of time and energy. We need to get past that. Quit looking forward to elections. And this kind of goes along the same lines here. If we could just get the right people in place, we could turn this thing around. You know? If some crazy psycho sniper or whatever could take out a few Supreme Court justices, you know, and we could kind of have a changing of the guard with the right person making the appointments. Oh, man. With 6 months of good work, or with me as absolute autocrat for a year or so, you know, maybe we might be able to pull this thing around. Maybe we ought to be able to make this work. How many times have we bought into candidate A? Because he's tall and he's good looking and he talks really nice and he says all the things we want to hear. And if we could just get this guy in the governor's chair or get him in Congress or get him in the White House or whatever it happens to be, and it's usually him, sorry ladies, then everything's going to be different. And we get him in and nothing's different. How many times are we going to go through this? I'm not saying don't vote. I'm not saying that politics don't matter. I'm not saying that you need to withdraw yourself from public life. But electing the right people is not going to turn Satan's world into God's world. These people are not trying to do that. Even the good ones. The enemy is the devil. The enemy is not the president or the Supreme Court or your local congressman or whoever happens to be. Your enemy is the devil. And elections are not going to take the devil out of power. He is not on the ballot. I will read this. Ephesians chapter 6, verse number 12. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. And that's one of those not but phrases that I talk a lot about. Yes, we got a lot of bad people out there. Yes, they're trying to do bad things. But that's not the real problem. The real problem is sin. The real problem is the devil. And if we can work it out where the devil's not an issue anymore, then we can start talking about important elections. But as long as he's ruling in the kingdoms of men, there's a limited, extremely limited amount of good that can be done through elections. One of these days, the rule of this world is going to be cast out. Jesus tells us in John chapter 12, verse 31, that day may not be tomorrow. It may not be next month or next year. And there's absolutely no reason to think it's going to happen on election day. Whatever circumstance we have, that's what we live with. That's what we find, where we find an opportunity to glorify God. A couple more here. Appreciate what you have. Don't pine away for what you don't have. God continues to bless us in this country and in other countries too. We are marvelously blessed. And he says here to people, no doubt, who had a whole lot less than we did, certainly didn't have air conditioning and Wi-Fi and all that. Here's what I have seen, Solomon writes in chapter 5, verse 18, to be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. For this is his reward. Furthermore, as each man to whom God has given orders and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. What he's saying here is, if you go out there into the world and you work really hard and you do the best you can for your family, you do the best you can for yourself, you wear yourself out where you sleep nice and steady at night, and whatever kind of food you're able to provide, you put it on the plate, you eat it, you may get so busy living your life that you forget how miserable you are. You may be so occupied with the good things that God has given you in whatever quantity there is that you don't have enough time to sit around thinking about what might have been, what could have been, what other people are going through. This is your happiness. Not to look at the Joneses and say, well, you know, he's got a 2.5 car garage. I only got a 2-car garage. What's with that? Don't worry about that. Don't worry about, you know, I used to be doing really good, and then that stock market business happened, and I lost all my savings, and I had to leave my job and go dig ditches for a living, and man, 10 years ago I had it made, and well, here we are now. Don't do that. Don't do that to yourself. Live where you are. Find your joy where you are. Quit thinking of yourself as a victim. Please, quit thinking of yourself as a victim. Life is not something that happens to you. We try to tell the children that they're not the center of the universe. That they need to think about other people. They need to think about other circumstances. You know, this isn't about you. This is about somebody else. But then we as grown-ups, we find that we can't think of anything but ourselves. And if I have a bad day, well, I got to tell everybody about it. And that brings up Facebook again, right? Oh, let me tell you. Oh, it's awful. We were cooking Friday night. We had a little competition kind of thing at the house. We'll tell you about it later. And I'm trying to cut the burn part off of a hot dog bun that stayed in the pan for too long. And the bread knife goes through the bun thing. And it hits me right here on the finger. I got this cut here. I mean, it's bugged me for a day and a half now. I can't take it. You would not believe the inconvenience. I'm trying to type with this. That's a typing finger right there. That is not reasonable for me to have to put up with this kind of thing. Woe is me. Look at me and all my problems. The world's out to get me. Don't go down that road. Don't think of yourself as being victimized by your government, by your parents, by your friends, by your bank account, by anything. You are not a victim. You're a child of God. And you get to choose your destiny. You may not get to choose your bank account balance. You may not get to choose the physical things of this world. But again, is that important to you? Is that the real issue? And if not, why are we spending so much energy on it? The only consideration is what Moses told the people back in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 19 and 20. I'm putting before you here life and death, and you need to choose life. Well, you've chosen life. And that's marvelous. Most people choose death. We don't get it, but they do. You chose life if you're a child of God. Life is good. Life doesn't get any better than that. So instead of fussing about how things could have been if so-and-so had gotten elected or if I had gotten the raise instead of that idiot Bob or whatever, praise God where you are. And we'll close with this one. Project an image of confidence. I'm hoping that this lesson comes across as a positive kind of thing. I realize that it might not. This is not intended to be depressing. This is intended to be empowering for the people of God. It's not a good thing, an inherently good thing, that we lose our privileges or lose our rights or lose our protection or whatever. But the blessing comes in when we realize that those things don't matter all that much and the important things have not changed at all because they are in the hand of God. And if you go into the world believing in God, acting in faith, in confidence, in security, in the midst of a world that is crumbling, not just for you, believe it or not. Other people are struggling too. Other people are going through the same problems you are. How does it look when they are suffering the same indignities, the same problems, the same doubts, the same fears that you are, and they're losing it, and you're not? Can you believe what? Yeah, I know. Hey, you know what? 40, 50 years and it'll all be over. I'm not worried about it. There is something intoxicating about that. There is something unbelievably attractive about that. If you can show your neighbors that you refuse to live in fear, that you refuse to live in doubt, that your future is secure, and it doesn't matter what the headlines say. It doesn't matter what you read on the internet. I'm fine. And if you want to, you can be fine too.
Do you think people might be interested in the gospel like that? A gospel that would not necessarily change the things of their world, but could change their entire world, their entire worldview, where suddenly the very tangible, very real problems of this life are rendered insignificant. Because we're not looking at them anymore. We're looking at the things of God. We're looking at eternal things now and living our life in faith. Show your neighbors an option. And we'll close with Philippians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7. Be anxious, he says, for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. I suppose you've probably read that passage a few times. You've probably heard me read it to you a few times. Let's let that stick with us. Be anxious for nothing. Whatever happens, whatever doesn't happen in your life, lay it on God. Trust in Him. Put your faith in Him. And you'll find, I suggest to you, that the indignities and hardships and inequities and general problems of this life may not go away. In fact, I can pretty much guarantee you they won't go away. But they might as well, because we're not living in that realm anymore. We're living in a glorious realm. And temporarily we're displaced. But one day we're going to be physically displaced. And I don't think for a second that we're going to be sitting around in heaven wishing that the first decade of the 21st century had gone different. Wonder what would have happened if we had elected X instead of Y. Wonder what would have happened if this ruling had gone this way instead of that way. Do you really think that's going to be a hot topic of conversation in heaven? I doubt very seriously we're going to be interested in those things. What we're going to be interested in is what we're supposed to be interested in now. And that is how glorious our God is and how marvelous it is to live under His protection and His care. If there's something we can do for you to help you come to your Savior, to help you be confident, to be Christians, including becoming a Christian, by the way, if you aren't. If there's anything we can help you do to help you find your strength, to find your courage, to find your faith, we want to help you in whatever way we possibly can. If you need help from the brothers and sisters in Christ here, if you want us to pray for you, pray with you, so that you can come back to the Lord and have the kind of encouragement, the kind of strength that you need that'll get you through a difficult time here on this earth and get you into an eternity in heaven. Whatever we can do for you, please respond while we stand and sing to encourage you. Jesus, the loving shepherd.